Okay, I'm going to call to order this meeting of the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. It is Monday, the 13th of March. Welcome, everyone. Colleagues, hope you had a good weekend. And we've got a rich week ahead of us, including, I will say, today's hearing, which I'm really looking forward to, our informational hearings. But before we get into those, we have a couple of quick business items we have to get through. And so we are going to address today's agenda backwards. Some people think we're backwards all the time, but today I will concede we're going to go backwards. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2746. And colleagues, I'm also hoping that we can do a work session on this today. As you know, normally I like to have public hearing one day, work session on another, but this is one that I think is pretty straightforward, and we're under some time constraint. So, Beth, would you read the bill? While we have Paul Romaine, Becky Volkel, and Brian Anyway, if you could, the three of you could come up, please, while Beth reads the bill or the summary.
We can go to work session right now, you know.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2746 would address the payment of refunds on beverage containers that are subject to the bottle bill. The bill has minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
Okay, thank you, Beth. Who's going to start? Beth? Okay, please.
Good afternoon. I'm Becky Volkel. I'm the Bottle Bill Compliance Specialist with the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. The OLCC has not had an opportunity to take a position on House Bill 2746. However, the bill addresses a key requirement of the agency's administration of Oregon's bottle bill. OLCC has statutory authority to administer and enforce the bottle bill, and OLCC works daily with distributors, retailers, redemption centers, and consumers to make sure they are complying with state laws. However, the agency does not play a role in setting policy around the bottle bill and has limited authority to adopt administrative rules governing the bottle bill. The redemption value on containers will increase from 5 cents to 10 cents on April 1, and on January 1, 2018, additional beverage containers will be added to the bottle bill. This expansion covers any beverage intended for human consumption, except for distilled spirits, wine, milk, and infant formula. The increase in refund value, as well as the expansion to additional containers types, poses practical challenges for retailers and distributors to have containers in stock that are labeled under the prior requirements. House Bill 2746 does not affect the redemption value for containers established in current law, but allows retailers and distributors flexibility in meeting label requirements. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Becky.
Senator Dembrough and members of the committee, my name is Brian Detention. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Brewers Guild, and we strongly support House Bill 2746. It would provide the greatest benefit for the smallest brewers in the state and would allow them, it would give them the flexibility to, because they have sometimes a slower rate of sell-through in retail establishments, it would provide them probably the most benefit. We ask that you open up a work session and pass this out of committee. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for coming, Brian. All right, Brother Romaine, explain this.
Senator, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine, representing the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association. And Senate Bill, or House Bill 2746 is actually a very simple bill. I like to call it the Hogwarts Bill. Unfortunately, we're not in the world of Harry Potter, and we can't just magically on April 1 change all labels out there. So we have 5 cent labels that are in the market now that will stay in the market through April 1, past April 1. We have 10 cent labels that are coming into the market right now, but they're only worth 5 cents until April 1. What this bill is just makes clear that if you you pay your deposit and your refund value prior to April 1 is 5 cents, no matter what the label says. After April 1 or April 1 and after, it's 10 cents, no matter what the label says. That's the only thing it does. We did this. It's actually OLCC policy, but we felt a lot more comfortable actually having it in statute so we avoid any confusion out there. We appreciate your support of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions, colleagues?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, Vice Chair.
I was thinking of Sarah. Too many committees for too long. Ma'am, you had mentioned that the expansion of the bottle bill for anything that's consumed. Are you going to include for human consumption Pepto-Bismol, which I use a lot of?
Senator Devereaux, Senator Olson, no, we wouldn't include that. We don't consider that to be a beverage.
Apparently, yes. Senator Olson
really
does.
Yes.
You've never met Senator Olson before,
really,
have you?
No. So, you know, when you take your shot glass in the morning and you start off, it's a beverage. So you're going to be looking only at beverages?
Yes. Again, Senator Devereaux, Senator Olson, we have authority to exclude some other items, and we will be looking at things like
it was one of the arguments I had on the floor when that bill passed 2 years ago, that lemon juice and Pepto-Bismol and some of the other things could be included in the future because they are typically in plastic bottles. So I thank you very much for answering that question.
Okay, colleagues. Any further questions? Okay, seeing none, thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2746, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2746. And Senator.
Chair Denver, I move House Bill 2746 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Olson has moved House Bill 2746 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection to the measure? Seeing none, the measure passes. I'll carry it to the floor.
You'll carry it. Looking for
okay. I don't want any Pepto-Bismol stories. So with that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2746 and open a work session on Senate Bill 812.
Chair Denbrough, I move Senate Bill 812 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Olson has moved Senate Bill 812 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And colleagues, just to remind you, this is the bill that modifies the septic loan program. We heard it last week. Mm-hmm. Any discussions? Is there any objection to the motion? Okay, the motion carries. We'll have Senator Roblin carry. And with that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 812. And now, at long last, or short last, we move to the informational part of today's meeting. Colleagues, I'm really excited about today's hearings. As you know, we live in a state with very rich natural resources, and some of them are in our forests, and some of them are in our rangeland. And we want to make sure that those resources are used appropriately, sustainably, in a way that moves Oregon's economy forward. And we're going to be hearing about several of the programs that seek exactly to do that. The first one is about Oregon's innovation with cross-laminated timber. So I'm going to open that first section of our informational meeting. And Len.
You're carrying
the I'm ready.
No, it didn't pass.
That's good.
Always good at shitty bills.
All right. Okay, Len, you want to get us started?
Yes. Senator Denbrough, members of the committee, thanks very much. My name is Len Bergstein. I'm delighted to be here introducing this panel on cross-laminated timber and the project called Framework. Just this weekend, NPR did a wonderful story on this subject, and they really pointed out why I think you were interested in this when we talked about it. This is right in the sweet spot of this committee. It's really urban Oregon and rural Oregon working together really to benefit all Oregonians. And so we're delighted that you wanted to give us a chance to kind of talk about this, and I'll turn this over to the panel. Anule will be the lead speaker. Thanks.
Okay, great. Any life, welcome.
Thank you. I'm hoping that works.
Is it popcorn time before the movie? Or?
Sorry about that. Magic hand. Next time I won't try the full screen. Yep.
Yeah, okay. While you're fiddling, colleagues, I'm going to reopen the work session on Senate Bill, whatever it is, 812, for the purpose of allowing Senator Roblin to vote on this.
Do we need to do a suspend the rules?
Probably, technically, yes.
Just throw that out.
Not among friends.
He'd be a no on that one.
Vice Chair, do you want to make a motion to suspend the rules?
Are you suspending the rules?
I make a motion that we suspend the rules to allow Senator Roblin to cast a vote on Senate Bill 812.
Okay. Vice Chair Olson has moved that we suspend the rules for the purpose of allowing Senator Roblin to vote on Senate Bill 812. Is there any objection to that motion?
Yeah.
Seeing none? Okay. So the rules have been suspended. Senator Roblin, how would you like to cast your vote on Senate Bill 812?
What's that bill? Oh, yes.
Senator Roblin is an aye on septic, as always.
I'd love to carry.
Okay, so let the record show that Senator Roblin has voted aye on Senate Bill 812. I will close the work session on Senate Bill 812 without any further modification as to carrier. Okay, we're back in the information session. Sorry, thank you.
Thank you. My name is Anyale Halova, and I'm a partner with a company called Project. We're a commercial real estate developer in Portland, Oregon. We've done work in Portland, in Eugene, in Corvallis, and also in Bend. I'm here to talk about the origins of this project and some of the benefits that come out of it. After me, Jonathan Trutt, who is the director of development from Home Forward, will talk about the affordable housing components. Thomas Robinson from Lever Architecture will talk about the innovative nature of this project and why it's special in the United States. And then Valerie Johnson from DR Johnson will talk about the economic benefit of such a project to companies like hers and the industry in the United States. And so the project is called Framework, and it's going to be located in the Pearl District in Portland, Oregon. And it's going to be located on the intersection of 10th and Gleason, currently where the Albina Community Bank is located. And a lot of people ask us, you know, about the origins of this project, because it's very unique, and why would a commercial real estate developer engage in such a innovative project? We had been talking to Beneficial State Bank.
You don't have to be so close
okay.
to yeah, just
yeah,
you
there
can
we go.
Move it away from
you. We had been talking to Beneficial State Bank, their community bank, and they are owned with a parent company that also owns Albina Community Bank. And they're both very mission-driven banks where their profits from their banks essentially go back into the communities that they serve. So they go back into small business loans, they go back to helping businesses that are catered towards sustainability, or also minority and women small businesses. And so they're really mission-driven. And their three values as a bank are economic opportunity, social equity, and environmental responsibility. And so we were essentially hired to develop a project for them that embodied these values. And as we were getting into it, we were really thinking about environmental responsibility. And, you know, Portland's known, Oregon's known for being on the forefront of that. In more recent years, a lot of other cities have kind of taken that, which is the point of this, and really run with it. And, you know, all of the professionals engaged in this industry are thinking, you know, what is the next thing? How can we start to think of buildings as being sustainable, not just in the things we add to them, but actually at the core of the building itself, in the materials that we build with? And also thinking about the life cycle, not just the building in that moment in time, but really, you know, from the inception of those materials all the way to the life cycle of those. And so around that time, we started to think about, you know, how could we marry that with the economic opportunity? Is it just about who builds the building and that short time frame, or is it really about the kind of communities that are created through a building project? Around that time, CLT, or the idea of mass timber, was starting to generate as a thing that Oregon and Oregonians were interested in. We started to explore the use of that in a building on the site, and we quickly realized that it was a very risky venture. Right now, you're not allowed to build a high-rise out of wood due to that it's a flammable material. And they had been building these in Europe for the last 20 years and in Canada more recently in the last 5 years. And so we had heard that, so that quickly squashed that idea. So we had heard that the USDA, along with the Softwood Lumber Board and the Binational Softwood Lumber Council, were coming out with a competition to essentially fund the first of this kind in the United States. They had done this in Canada, and they were modeling that idea to create those here. So we said, why don't we go for this award? If we win it, that will give us the money. It was $1.5 million to do the research and testing needed to prove out this technology. I've been telling a lot of people that this project is pretty much two different projects. It's a research and development project, and it's also a real estate project. The research and development that's gone into this will help all projects that come after it, and the real estate development project is really a realization of that research. So we went for the competition, and we ended up winning. You can see us here with Secretary Vilsack in New York. There was a team out in New York that also won the competition, so they had an East Coast and a West Coast winner. The result is a framework, a 12-story building with retail on the ground floor, five floors of office, and five floors of housing. And you can see on the left the idea behind it being an all-wood building, which is very unique. And one of the things that they told us about us winning the competition was that we understood that this was not just a project. This wasn't just a building, and then you say, well, we have the first, and call it a day. It was really about creating an ecosystem, and it was an urban and a rural ecosystem, one where wood that's harvested from Oregon forests go into the lumber mills and actually add value by creating engineered wood products. And those eventually going to tall wood buildings such as Framework, which would fuel the future sustainable cities. And understanding that it was an environmental product in the sense of wood being holding carbon, and when you put wood in a building, essentially buildings are sequestering that carbon rather than potentially in the future dying and or being consumed by forest fires. And so this is a diagram of the building uses that you can see here, with the top part being dedicated to affordable housing. And so I'm going to turn it over to Jonathan Trutz shortly. But the idea really here was, rather than thinking of here's some office space, here's some residential space, they happen to be located next to each other or on top of each other, it was really thinking about what programming, what office users can you put in this building that would actually create value for the people living in the affordable housing. So the idea of the bank offering individual development accounts to kind of help generate wealth for those residents that are living in that building so that they could actually eventually move out and more people can come and live in the building. So really thinking about that, really targeting that speculative office space to be corporations or corporations that are interested in promoting social and economic value.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Anya.
Thank you, Anya. And Senator Dembro, members of the committee, my name is Jonathan Trutz, and I am the Director of Development for Home Forward. We are Multnomah County's housing authority. So we're a public agency. We're approximately 75 years old. We're the core of Multnomah County's affordable housing infrastructure. Our mission is to assure that county residents with low incomes are housed. We're the largest affordable housing provider in the state, serving approximately 15,000 households in Multnomah County between our own real estate portfolio and our Section 8 program. More than 80% of the households we serve earn less than 30% of area median income, so very low income households. So why Framework? Why are we especially excited about this project and this partnership? One reason is that it's affordable housing in a choice location. The Pearl has been an enormous success, and that success has been catalyzed by significant public investment in its infrastructure. And Framework represents an opportunity for households with low incomes to reap the benefit of that investment in transportation, that investment in parks, that investment in, well, both when I say transportation, roads and mass transit. So Framework is in the middle of a high opportunity neighborhood with fantastic transit connections, which means that the people who live there, whether they work in the Pearl, in the service industry, or elsewhere in the region, can get to where they need to go without needing to own a car. That's a significant savings for them in terms of their household budget, and of course, that's better for the environment and reduces traffic. We're also extremely excited about the public-private partnership opportunities that this project represents. So throughout our history, we've found that partnership is instrumental to meeting our mission. And here we have an opportunity to partner with Project, a civic-minded developer that does all kinds of very interested things, and Albina Bank, a mission-focused bank that shares our goals of community improvement, and a bank that we have been doing business with for over a decade. And Framework also represents an opportunity to leverage private investment and meet multiple public objectives simultaneously. So I've talked about the value of affordable housing in the Pearl, but it's also a significant economic development opportunity for the city in the fact that this could really unlock CLT for tall buildings. And that would put us in a significantly advantaged position vis-a-vis other parts of the Northwest and the country as we think about 21st century economies. We are really excited about the rural-urban link and the timber jobs that this could help sustain in rural Oregon. And we know from the households that we serve that approximately one-third of the homeless population in Portland comes from other parts of the state, and that's driven in large part by the economic situation in many of our smaller towns. As we briefed our board about this project last year, one of our board members described this as exactly the type of project government should be investing in, and that's what's catalyzed our commitment to it and investment in it, and we're really excited to see it move forward.
Okay, thank you very much, Jonathan. Thomas.
Senator Dembrough and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to share with you the work that we've been doing on Framework. My name is Thomas Robinson, and I'm the principal and founder of Lever Architecture. We're an 18-person firm based in Portland. Oregon is, I think, truly innovating in cross-laminated timber in a way that I believe reflects the legacy of this particular product, wood, you know, in our state. And what I want to do today is really discuss two projects that I think demonstrate this. First is our office, which this is a panel from our office in North Portland. It's the first domestically fabricated CLT building in the United States, made with panels from Valerie's plant. And this project just finished up in September. And then go into more detail about Framework, which would be basically the first high-rise building in the United States and the tallest all-mass timber building in North America. And I stress the word high-rise because there's a huge difference between the building that we have our offices in right now, we're actually working on Framework, and the Framework project itself. So this truck, which Valerie's firm owns, left Riddle, Oregon, middle of February at 6 a.m. It arrived on our site in North Portland at 9 a.m. And basically by 12:30 p.m., we'd placed 4,000 square feet of floor. So basically 3 hours, more than 1,000 square feet an hour. Very quiet, very precise. And you can see sort of how this kind of goes together. It's basically everything you see here was grown and fabricated in the state. The connections that we detail with our engineers are seismically appropriate, and the entire building above the concrete foundation is engineered to the eighth of an inch. So if you're involved with construction, you know that's a pretty tight tolerance. Some of the details of how these pieces go together, I think one of the important things is this Framework's not our first CLT building, and we learned a lot from building this building. And I think we're taking that, which is a market rate CLT building, and we're applying that efficiency to a much more complex project. Some of the views, the one thing about the project is it's also beautiful, and we love being in the space, and it's a place that, you know, and it's not this squashed, it's just the slides. And we invite you to actually come and visit if you want to learn more about the project. It's open to the public. There's actually a nice bar in the back. Framework high-rise wood. So what makes framework special and different? Well, it's really it's different than anything that's been done, you know, in the United States and in some respects the world. So, and I'll talk specifically what those are. So the first thing is when you go above 85 feet, you're sort of outside the code relative to this building. So there's no way you can actually build a tall building above 85 feet without going to what's called a performance-based design. A performance-based design is sort of a section of the code that allows you to sort of say, here's what we're going to do. We're going to do this testing. We're going to do this modeling. We're going to get an independent peer review. And we're going to lay out a path for doing a building that's outside of the code. And that's what we've done. And that's really what that grant that Anule was talking about, the $1.5 million, that's what it's paying for, is the testing and the review. And what the way we're doing that is we're really innovating at a almost cellular level in that working with the researchers that are working at OSU and other parts, PSU and around the world, to really understand the material properties of wood. This is an electron microscope view of the wood fibers. Really understand how wood behaves. And instead of taking large trees like we've done in the past and cutting them up into relatively still very large members to build tall wood buildings, what we're doing is we're actually taking smaller pieces and through the understanding of the properties of the material, creating engineered wood products that are stable, strong, and can be prefabricated, you know, at very large sizes. The other thing we're doing is taking advantage of the inherent material properties of wood to address some larger issues in Oregon, the issue of earthquakes and seismics. So wood has a very high strength to weight ratio, and what we've done with this building is really innovated with a new, what we call sort of resilient low damage design. This is a post-tension cross-laminated timber rocking wall. I know it's a mouthful, but basically if you think of my arm as one of those walls you see on the left, there are eight of them, and it's post-tension down the center with steel rods. So in an earthquake, it can move, but it then gets pulled back to center. This is a very important thing if you're aware of some of the earthquakes in Christchurch where the buildings survived, but they had to tear down the entire city. This is the technology that they're using in New Zealand right now, and we're taking it to another level. So some of the details of how that works, we could spend about a lot of time talking about that, but just to give you a sense. The other thing that's really important for us is this building, that when you're in the building, you really understand that it's a wood building in the city. So we've designed it so that when you walk by, you can actually see the wood core, and that core is visible all the way up the building. So we see this as a building that's basically, in a way, an iconic building for Oregon and the city of Portland, but also a place that would be a destination for people to learn more about the wood. This is the interior. It's a public space on the corner that will be open to the community. There's going to be a tall timber exhibit that's associated with it. Let me go back one. This is the office space that I only have, five floors of office. So what is one of our biggest challenges is there's other wood high-rises out there, but a lot of them are not exposing any of the wood, so we really wanted to find a way to expose the wood. And that's one of the things we've been doing with this testing, and I'll explain that in a bit. This is the affordable housing component. In these units, we're only exposing the ceiling. So this full-scale testing that we're talking about, we did fire, seismic, and acoustic testing, probably a total of like 35 tests of different assemblies, and those are all complete. How did that happen? We skipped. Hold on a second. There we go. Those are all complete. And how are we doing that? Wood, when it's massive, has inherent fire resistance because it chars at a constant rate. So in the past, old growth forests in Oregon, you could actually drive a wagon through them because basically you had the old growth trees, there were fires every once in a while that cleared out the smaller trees between them, and that was sort of how a healthy ecosystem worked. Well, taking that kind of inherent characteristics, basically that fact that wood chars, and actually using steel, which is incredibly strong but fails at a specific temperature, you can see this sort of famous image of the wood beam in the center with the steel folded over it. We're taking the steel and we're actually Let me see if that'll come up. Well, we'll wait. We're taking the steel and we're actually embedding it into the wood to protect it. So small steel elements in the wood and protecting it. And then we're actually putting those in a furnace and we're putting a load on them. And then those have to survive a two-hour fire test. So these are all done, they're successful and documented, and they're part of this project. This testing will become public and be able to used on other projects to allow people to go high-rise buildings. We're also doing testing with partners, academic partners in Oregon. So that is that same joint connection that you saw here being tested for drift in a seismic event. So basically we're doing that. The test was incredibly successful. We were able to go to three times the drift that is designed with almost no damage. We're also doing testing at Oregon State University. This is one of the kind of very key tests where we're basically taking that wall that I was discussing with you and we're putting it on its side and we're basically applying 500 kips, which is 500,000 pounds of pressure through that actuator, which is three times the amount of force that would ever experience. But we always like to test things till they fail. And then we're also doing acoustic testing. These are all tests for the residential portion. So just to summarize, Framework is really the first mass timber high-rise in the United States. It would be the first, it would be the tallest all mass timber in North America. It would be the tallest post-tensioned rocking wall system in the world. It's the first high-rise building with exposed wood of any percentage in North America. It's the first project carrying out fire tests that I described previously on the walls, the beams, the columns. And that's basically, that two-hour testing is a first of its type in the world, and we're getting people now calling us from London asking for the tests. So these are all, and then lastly, the tests will be made public and shared. So just with that, I want to conclude. I mean, our goal was to, like Anyalay said, is to have a project that gives form to the values that represent Oregon. And our view, those are innovation, sustainability, and really connecting urban and rural.
Thank you, Thomas. Ms. Johnson?
Yes, good afternoon, Chair Dimbrough and Vice Chair Olson and members of the committee. My name is Valerie Johnson. I am a co-owner, along with my sister Jody Westbrooks, of both D.R. Johnson Lumber Company and D.R. Johnson Wood Innovations. Our parents founded the lumber company in 1951 in Riddle, Oregon, in southern Douglas County, and constructed our glulam beam plant in 1967. Which was formerly known as Riddle Laminators and now known as D.R. Johnson Wood Innovations. When our expansion to manufacture mass wood panels in the glulam beam plant was completed in 2015, we became the first certified manufacturer of structural cross-laminated timbers, or CLTs, in the United States, and only the third certified company in North America. I am very pleased to participate on this panel to testify as to the benefits of the Framework Project and how it relates to both the economic growth of our company and our community, as well as the developing urban-rural connection we witness and sense growing stronger every day. The slide that you see up there right now, if you are the cameraman, everything behind this picture is our 50-year-old glulam beam plant, part of which is absolutely necessary to make CLTs. But everything in front of you in that picture is the expansion to make cross-laminated timbers. And Thomas showed you the way we lay up a panel. We buy dry dimension lumber from other lumber producers, lay a long layer down, glue extruder, puts glue on that, lay a cross member perpendicular, so forth. We can make three layers, five layers, seven layers. And once that is concluded, it rolls down those rollers to that. I hope you can see there at the end, it says USNR on it. That's actually our press. It goes inside the press. It's a cold set glue. The press comes down to about 120 PSI for 2 to 2.5 hours. There's actually tables depending on the air temperature and the humidity and so forth. And once that's done, the bright building or the bright machine over there to the left is a Hundiger machine, which is a robotic cutting machine, a computer numeric cutting machine. We brought that in from Germany. It's the only non-U.S. manufactured part of our facility. And it it cuts, excuse me, I think I'm hearing feedback. It cuts.
You can stay far away.
Thank you. It cuts. I'm so excited. Yeah. It can do marvelous specific fabrication. The drills or the holes for the screws, the anything that Thomas and his engineering partners need prefabricated on our panels, we can do that from our CADWorks expert up in the office, entering, downloading their very detailed, very specific design, and sending it down to this cutting machine, which is precise within a 16th to a 32nd of an inch on every cut it makes. So as I told them this morning, and I say this often, this machine is smarter than I am and could make your coffee in the morning if you told it, knew how to tell it to do that. So beyond that, I'm going right. This is just a sample again of the machine. If you can see the notch there on the bottom right, that's just, those are two panels that the CNC machine routed out. And of course, when they put together, they're perfectly synced up. So that's just a quick example of what I was just explaining. This additional product line of mass timber has helped us add already 11 to 12 positions. And we expect that when we are running full time on one shift, which we anticipate will be this summer, shortly thereafter, we will also add a second shift, probably within the next 12 months. The total increased employees at that point in our company will be 20 to 22 people, which in Riddle, Oregon, is a boom of increased employment, which would probably be similar to maybe 1,000 times that amount in Portland.
But Valerie, I assume these are not minimum wage jobs.
They are not. In fact, there are still some slightly labor-intensive jobs, which would be a little bit on the lower scale, still not down to minimum wage. But much of this computerized material is computerized jobs are highly skilled and much better paying. Again, Thomas has shown you some of the product testing. We have been in collaboration with the Framework Project on much of the testing, and some of the results that I just brought as quick samples. The one in the upper right is just simply a strength test. The one in the upper left was part of the fire testing that Thomas mentioned, and our CLTs have been tested. It's called a naked panel test, meaning no gypsum, no covering, no anything whatsoever on it. And in a two-hour fire test, which it didn't even fail at 2 hours, but that's the best fire resistance of any mass timber testing in the world. So they stopped at 2 hours. The one down in the lower left is potentially another very big market for mass timber. The Department of Defense is requiring all of the structures on their military bases to have some blast testing resistance. And so those are three separate full-scale buildings that were built. The one on the left is ours. The other two from one in Canada, one in Montana, a firm in Canada and a firm in Montana. But all three of those structures performed very, very well in that blast testing. And the Department of Defense is very, very, very hopeful that this might be a building system for them going forward. The urban-rural connection was done. This graph was done by an Oregonian reporter. It's about a year and a half dated right now, but I kept a copy of it in my hand ever since I first saw it, because all of those red dots at that time were active construction projects going on in the Portland metro area, which potentially every one of them could be interested in building with mass timber at some point. And so when you see the kind of potential there is just right here, even in our own backyard in the state of Oregon, it sort of puts a scale to what the possibilities are. And the project team and the building they are designing and testing is actually going to break open that market, I believe, and I think they do too, for many more of those projects to come in. It's also a significant source of pride for our employees to know that they are manufacturing products that will be used for construction in urban areas. The pride is not only because of the beauty of our product, but knowing that we are partnering with design and build teams like the Framework Project to provide a more environmentally friendly, lower carbon emitting, renewable and sustainable product for the increasing demand in urban areas. The urban-rural divide has existed too long in Oregon. Our people are now feeling proud of their work once again and beginning to believe that perhaps urban areas will respect what we do as well. Just have another slide here of a project that's definitely going forward. The state legislature is probably familiar with it. This is a rebuild of PV Hall on the campus of the College of Forestry at Oregon State. Our CLT panels will be used in that as well. And it's another example of the innovation and collaboration that the Framework Project, all the testing and engineering that's going on there. There's some sharing of information between those two projects, and much of what they are finding to be successful in the 12-story project will be used in future projects, such as PV Hall. And finally, I just want to go back to the interest of people to get into this type of a new product and being part of that. It especially interests young people. We estimate that we've hosted several hundred people through our plant within the last 2.5 years, and at least 150 of those visitors have been college students and college faculty members. This mass timber movement is for real. We get several calls, 2 to 4 to 5 calls per week, new projects, new developers asking questions, what does it take to get started on this? It is growing every month. The next generation feels it. These young people are from the University of Nebraska and came out specifically to look into what's going on in mass timber. The next generation feels it and is eager to be part of it. This not only continues to strengthen the cross-education and respect between the urban, suburban, and rural areas of our state, it strengthens a new generation of respect for one another. Chair Dimbrough, Vice Chair Olson, and members of the committee, we at D.R. Johnson thank you for your interest in this nationally significant 12-story project called Framework. We believe our efforts and your support of this project that is literally a laboratory for the revival of building with mass timber is an investment for which Oregonians will be grateful for many, many generations to come. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Ms. Johnson. I have visions of a field trip for myself. This is literally not your parents' mill right down there. It's very different.
I'm sorry?
This is not your parents' timber mill.
Yes. Well, the old mill is still running. We make larger timbers as well, solid sawn. But no, but I must tell you, this is something my dad's in heaven just clapping his hands on.
That's great. Could you say something about the forest product that feeds the mill? What sort of forestry is required by cross-laminated timber? Forest practices.
Cutting trees.
Anybody can answer that if you want to. Yes, trees is a good start.
Yeah,
big trees, little trees.
Yeah, typically bigger trees are not cutting a lot of dimension. There's characteristics in large trees that actually create sort of a lower grade dimension product. So basically your better dimension, which is what this is called, the 2x4 through 2x12, will be coming out of that smaller, medium to small tree size. We are right in the heart of the wood basket for dimension, wonderful Douglas fir dimension production. Everything from Northwest Oregon all the way down I-5, the lower Cascades, and on down into Douglas County. It doesn't have to be a high grade of dimension. 2 and better is fine for both of the outside layers, and then even a number 3, good quality number 3 without a lot of voids on it, is what's used for the filler in the middle. So it's really a very, very harvest-friendly product.
Great, thank you. Colleagues, questions? Senator Bettringer.
Oh, I got first. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is for the gentleman from the Portland Housing. I know you're from Portland, but you said something that really struck my ears when you talked about jobs in rural communities. Could you share with this committee your secrets to
stop the timber harvest protests?
Oh.
Because that's the only thing that's going to create the jobs in rural Oregon.
I don't have that secret, but I do think it's important to stress, and we do continually stress, that this is one state, and what happens in the urban parts of the state is uniquely and directly tied in with what happens in the rest of the state.
I don't know if that was the answer, but...
Well, I mean, as somebody who works for a public agency, I don't control people who may have different ideas about forestry practices. I can tell you that we're very excited about this project, and we're very excited about the jobs it may be creating in rural Oregon.
Chair, if I might just take a quick answer to that. This actually does change people's perception, though, of lumber production. I mean, people can see that the environmental benefits of building with mass timber. It's healthier, it's more beautiful, it's sustainable, it's renewable. They do start to make that connection, and frankly, some of the keenest interest have come from people who had thought they were staunchly against lumber production, and now they're seeing that it can replace other building systems, which are also not, I'm not trying to attack them, but this is a much more environmentally sensitive way to build. So it slowly the perceptions are changing.
And if I could just add, I think, you know, if you're interested in sequestering carbon, then it makes sense to leave the big trees out there, to be cutting the smaller ones and sequestering the carbon in structures.
Yeah, I think the whole, you know, one of the things that we're trying to do is basically create a supply chain that will be efficient and allow us to build this market, and this project is part of unlocking that.
Senator Roblin.
Yeah, actually, a couple questions, if I can. First, having viewed a house-type structure up in Whistler made of cross-laminated timber, they really extorted the idea that it's tendency to insulate and not need other insulation products was another big factor in these buildings. Are we seeing that same thing here?
You know, it's a little bit one thing at a time for us. I think, you know, we see that. It's just not, I mean, I grew up in an all-wood house, you know, I think compare that to, say, other materials, wood doesn't actually take heat off of you. So there's definitely qualities to wood that I think we aren't totally they aren't totally in the code, and I think as things evolve, people will see that wood has, you know, that value. And I think we're sort of saying one thing at a time. I know that in our own office, we're never cold. I don't know if that helps answer the question.
Okay, follow up. I mean, they had a house there that the only heating unit needed was to invite another friend. And they said when they were doing construction on it, they used a hairdryer to heat up the building inside because the insulated properties of mass wood is so much greater than any of the other insulation stuff that we're doing, depending on the size of the and the width of the walls. So that's one. The other one is that's a much lighter building than most of the other footprints you're going to have in Portland. Do you know the relationship between a building of this kind and a typical concrete steel building with regard to weight and therefore the need for the foundational structures?
Yes, it's you know, almost a third lighter. And I mean, that has a big impact on the seismic design because force equals mass times acceleration. So more mass, more acceleration, more force that needs to be resisted. So, you know, every building technology has its appropriate use. We think this is a very appropriate use for Oregon and for high seismic areas, the design that we're doing here. And, we, you know, one of the things that we talked about in the title, this idea of forest to frame, well, that's kind of a play on farm to table, which I think when it first started, people thought that's a crazy idea. Now organic vegetables and other things are a $1 billion business, and they're a really major part of the economy. So I think these are, you know, we're just at the start, and this project is sort of, like Valerie said, a laboratory to really unlock going higher and bigger, because you can't do that unless you have all the sort of resources to do the testing we have.
And my last one had to do with, is it difficult to work for a company called Project on a Project? Or is that
That's a good one. constantly have to say I'm from the company called Project.
Just thought I'd make sure that everybody
realizes
that.
It's a good one. I like it.
Thank you. So moving left to right, Vice Chair Olson.
Ms. Johnson, can I ask you, since I am a builder and I use glue line beams all the time, what's the structural difference between a standard glue line beam and a CLT? And is the load bearing and cost the same?
I don't have the specific load-bearing stats with me, but the obvious difference is that glue line beams are all glued in the same parallel direction. Mm-hmm. And cross-laminated timber are perpendicular one another, which creates in and of itself a much stronger panel than what you can get from a glue line beam. It's almost too strong at times. Part of the engineering is to make it, like these rocking walls, is to make it a little bit more flexible in a seismic event.
I hate to interrupt, but when you do a glue line beam, you have to give specific engineering to
we
it,
do.
The yeah. camber and all that. And I was just asking, kind of interested in the CLT, because it seems like you can use shorter waste wood for smaller beams. And I don't know if you do smaller beams with these, but it just seems like you could use shorter material that typically would get thrown away on a glue line beam.
Sure.
And you could put it into a CLT, which really sounds cool. And I just wondered if the load bearing capabilities of each are the same and the cost of the same.
Well, first of all, the panels that we make are typically 10 feet wide by, now we're going to be 36 feet. We're at 32 feet right now, 38 feet.
So the beams in your picture weren't, you didn't make those?
Glue-lamp beams we did. But yeah. We don't make those out of CLTs. We still make glue-lamp beams the old-fashioned way. Beams and columns, posts and columns, are still made because they have their own structural engineering requirements. And I just want to stress that glue-lamp beams actually have a higher lumber grade requirement on the top and the bottom.
Right.
They also have low-grade filler, whereas the cross-laminated timbers are just your average two and better dimension. So,
I mean, I think one thing that we're doing is on the framework project, we're basically able to span without a beam 15 feet with a 5-ply panel. Mm. So if you know lock deck, if you're a builder, you know that's maybe 6 feet. Mm-hmm. So we're able to actually, at the perimeter of that building, there's no perimeter beam because we're spanning beam to beam like a rib. So 15 feet. So it's a two-way spanning system. So it's really, and it's incredibly stable. Our building, Albina Yard, was built completely in the rain, no movement, because you're taking the grains of wood and you're crossing them together and you're putting them into tension. So basically they are very stable. And as you know, with a glue lamp, it can maybe expand slightly.
I think the idea is using the product that's best. You know, obviously we have steel in this building, we have concrete in this building, we have glue lamps, and we have cross-laminated timber, and it's kind of using each product for its unique qualities.
Well, and the final follow-up, it's one of the concerns of Oregon.
Yeah.
How do you deal with the moisture?
I mean, I think carefully. I think, you know, our building is kind of a test case. It was built completely in the rain. But I think you have to remember it's a solid material as opposed to a material with voids. And as we're building it, we're actually sealing it, the edges, as we go up. So we're sort of creating a deck that's shedding water. And then, and basically as we go up, and then we carefully dry it out. So, I mean, that's how wood buildings have been built in Oregon, if they're stick frame, if they're mass timber. And I think we know how to do that.
Is there a perspective to do it in a lot of residential construction?
I think, you know, I think in Europe, yes, they're doing tons of small residential out of CLT. There are different codes that drive that in some respects, but a lot of it is, you know, the chicken or the egg. You need to show that these projects are viable from a code point of view, and then the supply chain follows. I mean, what Valerie and I think our team, we're kind of doing both at the same time, but the key is to kind of have those sort of initial, I would say, catalyst projects that will then unlock the demand. And there are plenty of people that I think Valerie's talked to and that talked to me about, hey, we're really interested in doing this. We're really interested in investing serious money to open up new plants, and I think Valerie would welcome that. But they need to see that there's the market.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And one item that we touched on, but I wanted to go further, was the Oregon, the state's building code division. Most projects, you kind of do your drawings and then you hand them in and they start reviewing. They've actually been involved from the very beginning of this project, reviewing the conceptual drawings, schematic drawings, all the way till now, actually visiting the fire test in person, seeing them pass, being there at PSU and OSU to watch that testing go on. So it's very much a learning period, I think, for all involved. And it's also ensuring that them, along with the peer reviewers, we it's like having a whole nother set of amazing consultants who could have built this project too, reviewing the project on top of it. So we have a structural peer review team and a fire peer review team. And the idea behind all this is basically to generate the first code for a building like this. And I think Oregon is uniquely poised to do that because it's kind of hard to generate a new code if you're kind of in a vacuum. Being a part and seeing a couple projects go through, which the state is in the process of doing, allows that. And international code officials have actually been monitoring this project and watching it to see, you know, how the tests go and all of that in order to influence future building codes in the United States.
Thank you. And we have time for one last question, Senator Brzezinski.
Probably two, if I could. So I just want to follow up with Senator Berkshire's position regarding the protest and stuff. So, Valerie, my understanding from what you said and what I've always understood about the benefit of CLT is you are using younger wood in the sense of the age. Could you give us the age range of the Doug fir that you're talking about?
Oh, I can't really be, but I'm guessing it's somewhere in that up to 60-year-old timber. You know, where a tree grows differs in how long it takes to get to a merchantable size, but I would think probably 16-inch diameter down to maybe 10-inch diameter tree is kind of the sweet spot for most of the dimension mills that are making 2-inch dimension.
Yeah, and I think most people would refer to that as, lack of a better term, second growth or third generation.
Yep. Yeah, probably third or fourth in some cases.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so I think that maybe helped answer the question, because my understanding of the protest is more on harvesting or cutting out ancient and old growth and also clear cutting. And so maybe that gives a little more clarity there. But I did want to ask Thomas one question on your panel, on one of your pictures you showed the fire testing, and it was in San Antonio.
Yeah.
And is that Southwest Research Institute?
We just can't say it.
Yeah. We didn't. You did.
I was raised there, so.
Ah, okay. Yeah. Well, our team has spent a lot of time there. We did about, would say 15 tests there.
Next time you go down there, I'll tell you where to get some good Tex-Mex.
Well, yeah. So I heard that Senator Brzezinski set his share of fires down when he was there. Senator Robles,
just to be
last one question.
Okay. Who's building your connectors? Because you're putting these together and you have to connect it, which is another code issue, because they haven't really been developed that much. And I saw bunches of them. So who's doing that for you? And
it's a collaboration between our office, KPFF, the structural engineer, and an integrator fabricator. That fabricator is based in Vancouver, BC, and they also built the largest timber building in the United States currently, which is in Minneapolis. So we have that team as a whole working together, and also our fire engineer based out of Washington, D.C., David Barber. So that whole team is focused on creating those connectors. So we needed something that passes the two-hour fire test, which is no mean feat. We need something that works in a drift situation that you saw there. And we also need something that's cost-effective. And if you look at this connection, and if you saw previously the connection that we designed for our own building, this one's simpler. And that's what I'm saying, is we're learning how to make this more cost-effective. Our goal is to make this something that anyone can fabricate. We're not trying to patent it. We're not trying to say no one else can use it. We're trying to create, in a way, something like on the order of your typical steel details.
Okay. Well, thank you all very much for coming today. This is beyond exciting. And look forward to – so what is the timeline for this project, the completion date?
The company or the project?
No, for this
particular
project.
So we're hoping to start construction in the late summer or early fall.
And we're deep into the permit, so we're hoping in the next 2 or 3 weeks that we'll have a permit in hand.
Oh, come on now. You're 2 or 3 weeks.
No, yeah, we've been working on this for a while.
We've been working on this for a year. Yeah. We're really close.
And I think the difference between this and another project, just to say how unique it is, in normal projects you would say, this is the project we're doing, we get your investors together at the beginning and you'd start. On this project, we've had to go through what I'd call the second project first, which is all this testing before getting to the point where we're out for financing. So we're really working on that financing part to get it complete for that construction start date.
And once construction starts, how long will it take?
It's 14 months, and that's sort of what our contractor has been penciling in. We have a feeling on our side that it should be faster and will be faster, but considering this is kind of first time for many of the people involved, I think it's being a little conservative.
Traditional will be about 18 months.
Yeah. So even if it makes that 14 months, it's way faster than normal.
Great. Well, I can't wait. Thank you all very much.
Thank you all very much.
Okay, so into that part of today's presentation. For the next, where we're really going to be looking at the relationship between state and federal in our forests and rangelands, I want to ask Jason Miner, could you come up and just kick this off? This part of the agenda is called Federal Forest and Rangeland Collaboration, Strong Partnerships for Better Results. So, Jason, what does that mean?
Chair Denbrough, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jason Miner. I serve as the Natural Resources Policy Manager for Governor Kate Brown. What does that mean? Well, first, I want to thank you all for hosting an informational hearing to find out more about what that means. And I want to point out that we have two panels that will follow me today. The first panel will focus on forests and specifically the unique partnership in Oregon between the state, the Federal Forest Service, and local collaborative groups to increase the pace, scale, and quality of restoration on a mixture of lands, whoever may own them. The second panel will focus on the intersection of rangeland health and habitat, overviewing the distinctive partnership between state and federal agencies and local ranchers. And I should point out that that's a partnership, the SAGECOM partnership, that I think has won national attention for being innovative, collaborative, and leading to results that in many ways we weren't sure that we could get to when the collaboration started. The governor is keenly interested in these topics, both these topics, and to that end, she recently hosted a workshop in Bend, which I was fortunate enough to attend, in support of the Western Governors Association and the National Forest and Rangeland Management Initiative, which is an initiative of Montana Governor Steve Bullock, and has had several events around the West, including Utah and most recently Oregon. We were fortunate enough to host what Western Governors Association felt was probably the best of the meetings that they had, bringing together some of the most diverse panels to address these issues that they had seen, and proud of the work of our agencies in helping bring that meeting together. The workshop provided a great opportunity for folks all around the state to convene and identify policy reforms to increase the resilience of our forests and our rangeland ecosystems. In her opening remarks to that event, Governor Brown said that we know we accomplish more when we work together. We have benefited tremendously from this collaboration in Oregon and these collaboratives in Oregon. She also reiterated her focus on rural communities as the driver for including two policy option packages in her budget, one of which is the Federal Forest Restoration Program, and the second of which is the policy option package to protect sage-grouse habitat and rangeland health. Several of the folks that are here today and that will testify participated in the Western Governors Association workshop, and I left the two-day meeting with four key takeaways. They are that, first, we need to recognize that our existing collaboratives around the state, our existing collaborative efforts, are unique, and they need ongoing support. We can't take for granted much of the collaboration that's been built to date all around the state and the work that has taken. The governor's budget includes this type of support for both forest and rangeland collaboratives. Second, we must stay focused on increasing the pace, scale, and extent of the work, as well as the quality of the work. There is urgency. Urgency exists to grow the impact of our work both for our ecosystems and their restoration and for our local economies. Third, we will need to broaden our perspective about what restoration means. Much of the work to date has been addressing some critical issues, including fuel loading and the risk of catastrophic wildfires and wildfire. But our work today is critical. But I think that we left that meeting believing that it can be expanded to address some other landscape level threats, like invasive species, climate change, water availability, and the way that all those things interact to accelerate each other and create feedback loops that are harmful to our communities and our ecosystems. We need to begin to act now to address these growing needs before they get out of hand or more out of hand. And fourth, we must continue and develop even more incentive-based approaches to encourage collaboration at the local level. One of the things that I heard most clearly at the Western Governors event and have heard in working on collaborative processes from the Steens Mountain Advisory Committee, where I served for two terms at the nomination under President George W. Bush's tenure, that the work relies on the right people being in the right place at the right time. So much of it is something that you cannot necessarily legislate, you cannot necessarily mandate, but it requires people coming together. And to me, that speaks to the need for incentives. When you have incentives, people are motivated. You find those right people, you find those right issues, you find those right circumstances, and people are motivated to come together. So we need incentive-based approaches to encourage collaboration at the local level. Solutions are best acted on when there is broad support, ownership of the process, and ownership of the outcome. So with that and those four takeaways from the Western Governors Association meeting, I just want to thank you again for hosting this informational hearing on such an important matter. Let me close again by thanking the chair, thanking the committee. I find this work personally inspiring. I committed much of my career to it, and I appreciate the opportunity to work with all of the folks that you will hear from behind us on locally advanced solutions and to work with you on those. And you know, before I close, I should say, I want to thank the legislature in particular for funding a lot of the your partnership and funding a lot of the critical sage growth work that's taken place, 2015 in particular, stepping up. It is not something that is done by anyone alone, and your support has been critical. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jason. I completely agree that there are very important stories to be told here, and we need to tell them, and we need to hear them. So thank you. Anybody have any questions for Jason? Okay, thank you very much. And I'm going to bring up the our first panel, which is on the forest side, and ask Regional Forester Pena and State Forester Doherty and Sarah Altimus Pope. So, Mr. Pena, you're very welcome here. Ms. Doherty, you're going to lead us off. Thank you.
Chair Dembro, Vice Chair Olson, and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Peter Doherty, and I serve as the Oregon State Forester and the Director of the Department of Forestry. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today with two other leaders in a uniquely Oregon approach to increasing the pace, scale, and quality of restoration on our federal forest. It's been an honor to work with Jim Pena to pilot innovative programs in Oregon, such as our cohesive wildfire strategy. And Sarah Altimus Pope is a leader in her local community. Sarah's work is representative of the other collaborative leaders across the state who are critical to a new approach to managing federal forest. Technically, in a budget sense, ODS Federal Forest Restoration Policy Option Package is a new program. However, this program is rooted in work started by the Oregon Board of Forestry in 2008, and it's been funded for the past two bienniums with one-time funding. So for over the past 4 years, we've been supporting Oregon's network of collaborative groups in making strategic investments in federal forest restoration projects across the state. Our federal forest restoration program takes a systematic approach as opposed to a project-based approach. A key premise of the program is that scaling up agreement and quickening the pace of project-level planning is necessary to address the urgent need to restore ecosystems and reinvigorate local communities. So rather than investing in a few projects start to finish, we're investing in discrete pieces of the planning and pre-sale process to find cost and time efficiencies that can change how future projects are developed. And our investments are highly diversified. So the first group, using competitive process administered by OWEB, we have awarded grants to 13 different collaborative groups in the current biennia. We've made investments in a second set of investments. We've made investments on 11 national forests statewide in 4 of 5 BLM districts. Those investments include 21 data collection contracts for work ranging from traditional tree measurement to sensitive plant surveys, all with the intent to find a more efficient way to do business. And so this is supporting the NEPA and the planning process of collaborative groups. Finally, we have invested in ODF seasonal employees to work with the Forest Service and BLM personnel to assist with timber cell layout on 54 timber cell units across the state. The next phase of our work will focus on fully implementing the Good Neighbor Authority. Now, this tool was enacted by Congress in 2014, and it allows the Forest Service to authorize the state to carry out certain actions, such as non-commercial thinning, timber sales, and prescribed burning, so we can act as an agent for the Forest Service. To date, ODF has 3 Good Neighbor projects in place, and ODF&W is involved in several more. In our fourth project called Paddock Butte, ODF will implement a federal timber sale on the Fremont-Wainema National Forest in northern Klamath County. Timber revenue generated from this project will be used to recover the cost of implementing that sale and carrying out other restoration aspects, such as removing encroached juniper in the project area. While Good Neighbor Authority offers tremendous potential, without our federal restoration funding, we would not have the staff to develop projects like Paddock Butte. Instead, we'd lose our positive momentum that is having a real positive effect on both our forest and our rural communities. So in closing, I'm going to say I'm really optimistic about the partnership that the initial state investment has created between the Forest Service, ODF, and local collaborative groups. I see this work as a top priority for us. My state forester colleagues in the West are envious of the assets that we have and the progress we have made. And the legislature deserves credit for its foresight and willingness to invest in a different path to increase the value Oregonians receive from our federal forest. Our approach takes committed leadership from both federal and state agencies, and I can assure you that our success here in Oregon also takes folks like Sarah, who provide leadership at the local level to convene and facilitate discussions about solutions that work on the ground. Collaboration can be long, complicated, and tiring work, often addressing controversial topics. In Oregon, we've learned that hard work pays dividends, and I'm honored to be part of the solution along with Jim, Sarah, and other local leaders around the state. And with that, I'll turn it over to Jim.
Thank you very much, Peter. Jim, welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chairman Dembrow, Vice Chair Olson, and the committee members. For the record, my name is Jim Pena. I'm the Regional Forester for the Pacific Northwest region of the U.S. Forest Service. I'm located in Portland, Oregon. And thank you for allowing me to speak today. My travel schedule is going to take me out of state when I understand the Ways and Means Committee will be considering the ODF budget in several weeks. So thank you for this opportunity to add my experience to the mix. In my position, I oversee management of about 16 million acres of national forest in Oregon and have a responsibility for delivering state and private forestry programs through direct grants to Oregon Department of Forestry, which have totaled over $11.5 million in the federal fiscal years 2016 and 2017, which kind of overlaps the last biennium. I think for a little more context of what we've been doing together, I'd like to kind of cover some of our investments and activities across Oregon in 2016. And so we, the federal government, have invested about $106 million in Oregon in restoration activities. We've offered 448 million board feet of timber for sale. We've treated nearly 600,000 acres across all ownerships to reduce the risk of wildfire, and including more than 50% within wildland urban interface areas. We've treated about 360,000 acres for watershed health and 200,000 acres for terrestrial wildlife habitat. We've also hosted about 8.6 million visitors to national forests across the state. And we worked with 26 forest collaboratives within the state of Oregon. For us, that's a cross-section of the things that we've been delivering to the public in the state of Oregon. We're a multiple-use agency, and so it's not just one thing that we're delivering to the public. Oregon's investment in the Federal Forest Program federal forest management and the social infrastructure necessary for collaboration has paid significant dividends over the years. Through additional federal funds coming to the state through national competitive budgeting processes, some of the examples that has resulted in. And so nationwide, with limited federal funds, the agency has been taking a more competitive approach in funding restoration. And a large factor in achieving or being successful in those competitions is having a robust collaborative process that supports decision-making on the landscape, and having landscape treatments that go beyond just the national forest. And so here in the state of Oregon, we have three collaborative forest landscape restoration projects, which have contributed over $24 million in national program dollars in appropriated funds and over $8 million in additional partner matching funding since 2010. Since 2014, we've attracted and successfully began and have accomplished some Joint Chiefs landscape restoration projects in Oregon, totaling over $9 million of Forest Service investment from our national office and nearly $7 million of Natural Resource Conservation Service grants into private land treatments, as well as $750,000 of grants from the Forest Service to the Department of Forestry for work on private and state lands. Our success in other competitive funding processes have brought an estimated additional $20 million of Forest Service funds to Oregon. And so the collaborative foundation that the state of Oregon and the Forest Service have been investing in, I believe, is paying off in increasing our capacity to do more restoration work and increase our restoration footprint within the state of Oregon. Oregon Department of Forestry's investment through the Federal Forest Restoration Program has been strategically focused, as Peter has said. I think one of the things that I view the program is doing is giving us additional capacity and helping us to leverage work where we need a hand. And I think it really is helping us to move forward in keeping projects on track, and keeping projects on track and accelerating work that otherwise probably would not have been accomplished in the time frame that they're being accomplished now, and which would have resulted in less accomplishments in a given fiscal year. When I look at what we're doing with our joint investment in ODF field coordinators in identifying potential projects that we could collaborate on through the Good Neighbor Authority and through other places to place the investments through the Federal Forest Program, I believe that it's helping us to be efficient with that investment and really leveraging places where we can get the most accomplished for the investment. Forest Service and ODF field employees have worked together to mark unit boundaries, as Peter mentioned, on 40 Forest Service timber sales over the past 2 years. In total, these timber sales have accounted for about 256 million board feet. So one of the things that often comes up is the question of additionality. And when I think about that, the way we've been investing these, we've been looking at it from a synergistic standpoint. And so when we look forward to be able to better account for that additionality, we're going to be investing more energy into identifying what would have been done with our own funding as opposed to what is being done with that the synergy of the partnership investment. And so with that, I sincerely thank the State of Oregon and Oregon Department of Forestry for the partnership that we have had over the past years and the mutual progress we've been able to make in increasing the pace, scale, and quality of restoration on national forests in Oregon. We're committed to continuing our investments in this area of critical need into the future. And I also believe that we're committed to continuing to build and foster stronger collaborative relationships in local communities. I believe that that collaborative relationship is what's allowing us to make more decisions without appeals, without litigation, and actually being able to implement more work and more work that benefits local communities. So with that, I want to thank you, and I welcome any questions you have for me when it's that time.
Okay. Thank you very much, Jim. Before we hear about the collaboratives, more about the collaboratives, Jim, when you talk about restoration work, what are you talking about?
Talking about a suite of things relative to vegetation management, thinning, fuels treatment, dealing with noxious weed, noxious plant removal. From a watershed standpoint, improving fish passage, improving rearing habitat in primarily salmonid streams. To help restore listed salmon species, dealing with roads that are contributing to sediment to those streams to improve water quality by improving the design or closing and relocating roads that are needed to access particular areas. Those are the primary things that we're investing in right now. Wildlife habitat improvement is another area that we're investing in to help us improve the species that are listed so that they aren't as much of a challenge in operating on a particular landscape. The other thing that I think is important is we're investing in restoration on private lands adjacent to national forests, providing landowners with the capacity through Oregon Department of Forestry, as well as through bringing in our partners at USDA from Natural Resource Conservation Service, who can directly fund work on private lands.
Great. And finally, when you talk about thinning, what happens to the trees that you thin? Where do they go?
Right. And so they go to the mills within our working circles. Our projects where we exist, those mills are generally heavily dependent on federal timber. And so it's important for us to maintain and increase the supply of wood fiber into the market to be able to sustain those businesses and that economic activity in the community, as well as giving us a way to treat and restore the landscape. If we had to do this all just non-commercially, we would not be doing the number of acres that we are doing now. So it's critical that we have a mix of commercial and non-commercial activity that goes on. The fuel condition out there oftentimes produces a non-commercial component that we are putting into biomass energy market, but that's a pretty saturated market, low value. We're working with our research and other entities to come up with additional value-added material for that non-commercial piece. You might be aware of the project in Boardman where they're looking at torrefaction to use wood waste in place of coal. That has some, hopefully, some very positive and potential outlets for taking that low-value material out of the saw log and out of the commercial timber operators' bailiwick and put it into a whole new market stream that would help us get material out of the woods rather than having to burn it on site or just leave it lay.
Okay, thank you.
Just a quick follow-up. Sure. And part of the rules that you have to follow under federal government, you might make some money off of a project, but that money doesn't go back in to help you with the next project. It goes to another budget place. So you've got to find partners that allow you to get started in the next one because you can't use the stuff you just made on the last one. Isn't that correct?
So we have an authority called the Stewardship Timber Authority, and that allows us to take the receipts from activities on a particular project and reinvest them into that project area. And so that is a way that we can get more restoration work done. But it still needs upfront end loading to do the planning and to get that going. But we've accomplished about 40% of the projects we have in Oregon and Washington are stewardship projects. The rest are traditional timber or fuels projects.
Okay, one last question.
Go ahead.
Do you know what percentage of your federal forest that you are in control of is where you want it to be with respect to fire safety? And
I don't have a specific number, but I know that we have a lot of work to do. When we're treating about 600,000 acres a year, and we manage 16,000 acres, which maybe 50 to 60% of that needs restoration treatments. We need to increase our pace and scale and be able to have a larger footprint to get that done. We need to significantly increase that.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thank
you. Okay, Sarah, thank you for your patience.
Thank you, Senator Denbrough, and members of the committee for letting us speak today. My name is Sarah Altimus Pope, and I'm the coordinator for the Southern Willamette Forest Collaborative based in Oak Ridge, Oregon. First, I want to tell you a little bit about the efforts of Westside Collaboration, and then I'll share with you some of the outcomes my organization is working on. In Oregon, an estimated 26 forest collaborative groups provide stakeholder input on public forest land management. Last biennium, the Federal Forest Health Program extended state investments to Westside Collaborative groups. Collaboratives are working on projects that integrate ecological objectives, such as restoring diversity in previously managed stands, improving old growth characteristics, and improving habitat for fish and wildlife, while employing the local workforce and supporting local economies. Westside Collaboratives are working to increase forest restoration across ownership types using land management authorities, such as stewardship contracting, which allow proceeds from federal timber sales called retained receipts to be reinvested in the area and to complete restoration work. The Southern Willamette Forest Collaborative started 2 years ago by Oak Ridge community members who recognized an opportunity to work closer with the Willamette National Forest to get more work done, similar to the work that's been pioneered on the Siuslaw National Forest. Our model is based on using a shared learning approach to multi-party decision-making and bringing partners to the table early and often to find zones of agreement and avoid gridlock. State investments are important and create a multiplier effect through collaborative outcomes. In 2016, funding from the Oregon Department of Forestry helped us to increase our organizational capacity by funding facilitation for stewardship collaboration and monitoring assistance. The stewardship committee brought together 30 participants representing a dozen organizations for several months of field trips, workshops, and roundtable discussions. Through this process, the group made consensus recommendations to the Middle Fork Ranger District for two stewardship projects. When implemented, the projects should create $350,000 in retained receipts that can be used for restoration work in multi-jurisdictional stewardship areas. In addition, the Ecosystem Workforce Program provided important socioeconomic baseline research so we can measure the impacts of stewardship contracting over time. And I have a report I'd be happy to share with you from the Ecosystem Workforce Program. And this shows where service and timber contracts have gone from Willamette National Forest in the last 5 years. So this gives us a baseline as we move forward. We know what our impact will be out of stewardship contracts, which is excellent to have.
The local impacts of state investments go beyond just the work of our collaborative group. In addition, the Willamette National Forest receives state and federal implementation partnership funds. SFIP grants funded 7 ODF seasonal positions to work on the Middle Fork District, conducting fish and road surveys, stream mapping, and timber sale prep, which accelerated 25.5 million board feet of timber sales 6 months ahead of schedule, and then increased the annual timber target by 10 million board feet. More importantly, their work also updated data sets, which will streamline future timber sale planning, enabling the district to avoid typical bottlenecks as they do their planning. SFIP grants also funded LIDAR data processing that will inform current landscape restoration efforts and increase the scale of restoration on the district. We see many opportunities for future collaboration, but also recognize there are challenges. We recognize our group has opportunities to continue developing the stewardship contracting process on our forest, creating timber and service-related work for local contractors, and investing retained receipts on projects that benefit the watershed, and continue to scale up to larger forest restoration projects, such as the Rigdon Dry Forest landscape planning effort our group is currently undertaking, and continue to seek opportunities to innovate, such as exploring possibilities for implementing the Good Neighbor Authority. Yet there are challenges. Finding funding is difficult for young organizations such as ours in a relatively new field. The collaborative process is time-consuming, and it can be hard to keep all the necessary stakeholders at the table year after year. And unfortunately, results are not immediate. It takes time to see the full benefit of working collaboratively. So, knowing this, I want to share with you some of the conclusions from a recent Southern Willamette Forest Collaborative survey of our members. A majority of participants find the collaborative process improves communication and trust among participants and produces more effective and lasting outcomes compared to traditional forms of public input. In closing, support from the Federal Forest Restoration Program is critical to sustaining collaborative groups such as ours. And continued funding for this program is integral to improving the health and resilience of our forest lands and creating and sustaining restoration and stewardship jobs in rural communities. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Sarah. Thank you for doing this hard work. I know it's very hard work. Yes, Senator Brzozinski.
I just want to say thanks to Sarah, too. Sarah and I had the opportunity to have our paths crossed when she did an internship, and it's always great to see how she and others have made a difference in their community, and I've had a lot of praise from local community members in Oak Ridge, including the mayor, as to the work that she continues to do. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Senator Bradtree.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Pena, yeah, I was jotting down these numbers that you're rattling off. They're pretty quick, but I think I got them right. 16 million acres of U.S. Forest Service land in Oregon. And you're treating about 600,000 a year and $108 million to do that.
$108 million to do the whole full suite of restoration work.
So how many acres were treated on?
So I think I indicated there was 600 of wildfire risk reduction, 600,000, 360,000 acres of watershed health restoration, and 200,000 of terrestrial wildlife habitat. So if you add all that up, it's a little bit north of $1 million, about 1.1 million acres.
So do you have a cost per acre then? Because now it's hard to do the math.
So I think you've illustrated the challenge of dealing with the issues that we face on the public lands, and in particular on the national forests. We're a multiple use agency, and so we're trying to deliver a myriad of outcomes. And so it's not just as simple to say that you're gonna put in X investment and you're gonna get automatically out Y outcome. And I think that's the challenge that people working in collaboratives are trying to resolve. When I think of when I was a forester, working at the ground level, planning timber sales when I started my career, it was pretty easy to figure out because it was just me and two other guys doing it. And we got very little public input. And there was very little public interest at that point.
Well,
that's changed.
I've got another question because I don't want to take up a lot of time. I know a lot of people. But don't you find it a little bit ironic that a poor little state like Oregon with a very, very small budget and only 4 million people are taking hard-earned taxpayers' money and expanding your budget to do work on federal ground with a federal government that doesn't have to balance a budget and has a heck of a lot more money than poor little Oregon. Isn't that kind of ironic?
Well, I guess it's in the eye of the beholder. I'm not in a position to judge whether or not that's the best investment for the state. You are. I'm just giving you information on what that investment is helping to accomplish.
And one more, Mr. Chair.
One more.
When we first started this, because, you know, I've been involved in stewardship contracts in my private life, but and I've supported the collaboratives since the beginning. But we talked about having the ability for the federal government to reimburse the state for the seed money put out there. Has that pathway went forward?
Are you talking about the federal forest program or something else?
So, you know, when you, let's say you do a timber sale and you're able to take some of those dollars from the timber sale and reimburse the state of Oregon for laying out the sale.
And so that is, that's the model that we're using with the Good Neighbor Authority. And so if the state takes and administers that sale, they're able to maintain the retained receipts similar to a stewardship contract and reinvest that on federal land to improve or expand the amount of work that we're accomplishing. And I think originally when I was involved in discussions with the governor's office when this program first started coming up, I didn't step in the beginning, but I stepped in after a little bit. At that time, Governor Kipsover believed that that investment pay dividends for the citizens of Oregon more broadly, creating more jobs, more active economic activity that's going to benefit local communities. And I believe the benefit here is the synergy between the state and the federal government. I believe this program, as particularly when we couple it with the collaborative effort and the Good Neighbor Authority, gives the state of Oregon more say in what happens on federal lands, public lands, than what happens without the programs, and also what happens in other states that don't have something as a venue for the state to be involved in federal land management. And I think that, over time, can give us an opportunity to take some of the controversy out of who owns public lands in states between the federal government and the states, and at least that's my hope. Because that kind of controversy, as we've seen in Oregon already, is not productive.
Okay, thank you very much, Jim. And thank you all three of you for coming and sharing with us what's going on in the forest. But we have to move out to the rangeland now.
Thank you.
So, Kurt, could you come forward and Jim Rue to kind of quickly kick us off on this last part? Kurt, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Kurt Melcher, Director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. Thanks, Chair Dembrough, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee for my being able to be here today to talk to you a little bit as we change gears from the forest to the rangeland. And I will really be brief. I want to hit some high points with you. I know we have another panel behind us, and I certainly want my friend and colleague who drove 300 miles to be here in the middle of calving season to have an opportunity to talk to you as well. So with that, we're here to talk a little bit about rangeland and sage-grouse in particular. The state of Oregon, federal agencies, and the our great private land partners have been involved in a collaborative effort to conserve and restore sage-grouse populations over the last several years, ultimately with our goal to be to show the federal government a way to say that listing was not warranted, that is ESA listing of sage-grouse was not warranted. However, we've been working with these private landholders as well as federal agencies and monitoring sage-grouse from long before the ESA was even a twinkle in anyone's eye. We have a long-standing data set monitoring data on sage-grouse population trends. And part of the reason we're able to have that data set is due to some very unique characteristics, behavioral characteristics of sage-grouse. And we would be happy to come back at another hearing and spend an hour talking about sage-grouse biology and characteristics. But one of the things, the reason we have this information is also one of the reasons that sage grouse are in a great way potentially threatened over the long term, and that is great site fidelity. So the breeding males return to the same area each year to conduct the breeding activities. These areas are known as LECs, L-E-Ks. And that site fidelity, which makes it very easy for us to monitor because we, too, can return to those sites and literally count birds in their conducting their breeding behavior, also leads to great threats. They don't generally change breeding locations. They have a very high degree of site fidelity. So I want to talk very briefly. 2016 population across Oregon was up 14%, which at about 23,000 birds in our state. We're one of really the four main states, Idaho, Wyoming, and Nevada included. So up 14%. We did have one population, though, that continued down, and that is our Baker County population, which was down 10% in 2016, which continues a long-term trend. The Baker County population is down about 75% since 2005. We're working with the local implementation team on a number of actions to turn that population around I'll talk a little bit more of that here in a minute. So some of the key habitat threats for sage grouse are juniper encroachment. So we've got native plant species, juniper, that are encroaching in the range and leading to depressed sage grouse populations. We certainly have non-native and invasive weeds and grasses that are occurring now throughout much of the range. And then as a side issue or contributing issue, then that leads to additional and more intensive wildfires, which we won't go into all the details. Last year was a very manageable wildfire season, but over the last decade our wildfire seasons have increased in both size and intensity. So we're working to reverse some of these trends. We've done a lot of work collaboratively with private landowners as well as public land managers, and truly, it is a partnership. There are collateral benefits that go with this work. There are benefits to, first, other sagebrush obligate species, but there are also benefits as you restore native grasses. There are benefits to the livestock producers as well. So there truly are collateral benefits, both for species conservation as well as livestock production. And then we have worked on juniper removals, and we are seeing some correlations between juniper removal and sage grouse population trends. Really some impressive technology out there as well. Literally GPS tags that we can put on a sage grouse now and have satellite tracking information that shows us how they're utilizing habitat that's been restored or habitat that's not been restored. And then lastly, and transitioning into my colleague Jim Rue here, I did want to mention that there are economic development opportunities in Southeast Oregon. And certainly there are economic development opportunities that the state and local government is interested in pursuing, but always with an eye on sage grouse conservation. As a result of that, the Department of Fish and Wildlife, actually the Fish and Wildlife Commission, did adopt new mitigation rules related to development in sage grouse habitat. This would be non-traditional development, so this does not cover, for instance, livestock grazing. But The commission did adopt a mitigation policy, and the Department of Land Conservation and Development and the Land Conservation and Development Commission did also make some very important modifications to their rules. And then lastly, I would just mention that there were some key investments in the 15-17, this current biennium, that has allowed us to do a lot of this work. And I want to hand it over to Jim. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Kurt. Jim, welcome.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here. For the record, Jim Rue, Director, Department of Land Conservation and Development. Picking up where Kurt left off, about a year and a half ago now, in I think probably July of 2015, the Land Conservation and Development Commission modified a rule which would provide effectively a regulatory backstop. Our goal five protections in the land use system require an inventory of natural features, require local governments to list and protect those, and it has the force of law. So in the case of sage grouse habitat was in fact adopted statewide, or in at least in these seven counties, and protected by Goal 5. And we think that was probably the critical element in avoiding a listing. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service required that there be some regulation, and in this case, we were able to use the state's land use system to provide it. So what do we do? As Kurt suggested, we have a process by which the bird is protected, but we can also continue with economic development in those seven counties. So if a developer comes into the county, all of these LECs are now mapped on GIS. All of the surrounding habitat areas are also mapped. We know where they are. We know how much land is consumed. We know how much land is available for other kinds of development. To that point, the department is currently involved in a GIS mapping, a tabular accounting for habitat and development opportunities in the seven counties. We're working with the Institute of Natural Resources at Oregon State to identify those areas so that every county knows exactly what amount of land is available for development, where it is, and can deal then directly with applicants as they come into the county planning office. We pay for that that directory, that GIS mapping capacity, and we share it directly with county governments. We have also, last year we spent about $40,000 in general fund grants in Harney County, helping the county update its Goal 5 inventory. We're hoping that the other six counties will be able to follow in the upcoming biennium. And then lastly, as Kurt mentioned, thanks to your support in the 15 session, we were able to get a coordinator, Brett Brownscombe at the back of the room, is doing that work now at the National Policy Consensus Center at Portland State. But it is absolutely critical that, A, we have a staff person who does this coordination, and that we continue this commitment going forward. It's not a once-and-done deal. We have to continue to demonstrate that we are going to continue to adhere to the commitments that we made to U.S. Fish and Wildlife. So with that, any questions, we'd be glad to take them. Otherwise, we'd sure you'd rather hear from the others involved.
Well, let's see. Are there any questions for Jim or Kurt? Well, you're right. Thank you. Thank you both. Thanks. Very much for framing. Thanks. This. Okay, so we have our last panel today. This says Marla Ray, but there can't be another Marla Ray.
It says volunteer.
What is she doing here? She's retired.
Kathy McDonald and John O'Keefe.
Yeah, last time I talked, she said she'd never be back.
I know.
Hey. Shelley, do you, given my experience with my virus, do you really go straight to the last one, the fourth one? Chair Denver, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, my name is Marla Ray. Upon my retirement last year, I returned to my own native habitat in Jefferson County. I'm a volunteer with the Gateway Rangeland Fire Protection Association. Gateway is one of 22 Rangeland Fire Protection Associations, or RFPAs, located within the state of Oregon. They are in Baker, Crook, Deschutes, Harney, Jefferson, Lake, Melhier, and as Melcher said, site fidelity for the greater sage grouse, they're pretty much smack dab right in the middle of the boundaries of rural fire protection associations, rangeland fire protection associations in Oregon. RFPAs statewide are made up of farmers and ranchers. You'll hear more about that from John O'Keefe in a minute, primarily in central and eastern Oregon. About 800 volunteers protecting over 5 million acres of private and state-owned rangeland from wildfires. It's called Neighbors Helping Neighbors. The first one was formed in Malheur County in 1964. Oregon's system of RFPAs has become a model for other states. It's been replicated in Idaho and Nevada, and we know of other states that are exploring this important partnership. You know or otherwise have heard about the issues we experience with wildfires on the east side. It's a huge issue for all of Oregon. The Department of Forestry, landowners, and the federal government. It's also, as you can see from this map, a mega issue for the greater sage grouse because of the threats that are posed to wildfires. Ranchers not only provide the person power, equipment, in the instances of Gateway, for example, access to water resources is provided by my own family, and they are critical first responders. To that end, I'm going to make a pitch. I was prepared to testify when the Ways and Means Committee came over to Jefferson County in February to make a pitch for a program option package within the Department of Forestry budget. Profoundly sensitive to the issue that the legislature faces with its $1.6 billion hole or gap that's in there, but we have a very modest request. It's a $650,000, sadly, general fund to coordinate the 22 RFPAs in Oregon in training, as well as securing critical firefighting equipment, enhancing communications, providing us with safety equipment, and also assisting in securing federal resources. It's an absolutely critical service provided by the state, but for those 800 volunteers of farmers, ranchers, neighbors, sadly, we would spend far greater than that $650,000 in state general funds. So our request of you is to help us, in essence, become our champions with your colleagues in Ways and Means as the Department of Forestry budget goes forward. With that, John O'Keefe will have more information, and Kathy McDonald from the Nature Conservancy, whose staff helped me with this great map since I have done megaviruses in downtown Gateway.
Thank you. It's great seeing you, Mara.
Thank you very much. I'd love to say it's lovely to be back, but it really is.
Kathy, did you want to go next?
Thank you, yes. Chair Dembrough, Vice Chair Olson, and members of the committee, my name is Catherine McDonald. I'm the Director of Policy and External Affairs for the Nature Conservancy in Oregon. And I want to also thank all of you for taking time on these two really important issues, forest and rangeland health in Oregon. These are priorities for the Nature Conservancy. Today I'm here to speak on the rangeland side, but the Nature Conservancy is passionate about both. As you heard from Jason earlier, backed with funding from the legislature, the SageCon partnership really has been identified as a model in collaborative conservation, and our work here in Oregon played an important role in
the federal agency's determination that the sage grouse did not need to be listed under the Endangered Species Act. And this effectively kept state control and averted the need for some additional Fish and Wildlife Service regulations. In addition to collaborating on planning, stakeholders and scientists, our scientists here in Oregon, have been working closely with researchers at Oregon State University and at the Agricultural Research Station in Burns to really work on how we can improve the effectiveness of management of sage-grouse rangelands. And I brought a video with me, and if we have time afterwards, we can show it, that gives a great overview of the kind of and the level and depth of collaboration that's going on. Beyond the work in the video that describes our work to develop better decision support tools for land managers, we're also working together with those researchers to develop new seed technologies. And these precision restoration technologies are in the early phases, but we think we'll be able to triple the success of reseeding after big fires. So we're excited about that work. Oregon has built a great partnership across stakeholders and stakeholder interest groups between federal and state agencies and entities. And we really need your help to continue the momentum that we have built so far by having the state really focus on five key funding priorities that are described in a fact sheet that a number of the organizations involved in SageCon have been involved in, including funding to protect against fires and support the rangeland fire protection agencies, but also another $1.3 million that's needed for the other key elements of the sage-grouse action plan, mitigation coordination between the federal, state, and local entities, invasive species match funding, and funding for some work on the Department of State Lands efforts. So I just want to emphasize that if you can help us, as was discussed earlier, keep the momentum going, it's really going to be critical. The Fish and Wildlife Service will be reviewing their listing decision in 2020, and we really need to keep going to be successful in implementing the plan and meeting their criteria. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Catherine. President O'Keefe, welcome.
Thank you. Chair Dimbrough, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. I am John O'Keefe. I am president of the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. Also, I've served as a landowner representative on the team that wrote the Oregon Sage-Grouse Plan in 2005, and it was revised in 2011. I represented landowners and range permittees on the during the SageCon effort, Oregon's All Land, All Threats effort, a key part of the west-wide effort to prevent a listing of the greater sage-grouse under the Endangered Species Act. I've been active west-wide representing the Public Lands Council and the National Cattlemen's Beef Association on sage-grouse issues. I've hosted the Secretary of Interior, Sally Jewell, on my ranch as part of a tour that showcased the public-private partnership doing sage-grouse conservation in Lake County, Oregon. During all this time, the most inspiring effort was the Harney County Candidate Conservation Agreement with Assurances, a community-wide three-year effort to get it right, multi-generations of ranchers putting science on the ground, working with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to conserve sage-grouse and help themselves. This effort was made whole by the active involvement of the range scientists that work at the Eastern Oregon Agricultural Research Service Center in Burns, Oregon. After Harney County did this, other sage-grouse counties were able to take advantage of this stellar effort and adopt a similar document for their counties. As all this was occurring, active sage-grouse conservation projects were underway. Juniper removal was the most common activity. This helps the watershed, helps the range, helps the sage-grouse. It's a true win-win for the rancher, for the sage-grouse. But that was not the only activity. We were building capacity in our rangeland fire protection associations. You can't measure what does not happen. We will never know the cost savings from this effort, but it was huge. Policymakers in Salem often see ranchers vocalizing opposition to government programs, government regulation. I wish you could go out in the country and see ranchers working together with government firefighters, long hours on the ground working together to stop a fire. I could go on and on about Rangeland Fire Protection Associations, but instead I will submit a letter for the record from past OCA president and fellow Rangeland Fire Association member Bob Skinner. Also happening, ranchers are ensuring our grazing systems are compatible with sage grouse. We have the science. When grazed properly, grazed pastures are less likely to burn. Grazed pastures, if burned, are more resistant to invasive annual grasses. We have the science that shows properly grazed pastures have adequate nesting cover. This is one of the areas where we still have work to do with the BLM. Since the completion of the sage-grouse resource management plan amendments, we have learned that some of the habitat values in the planning document are based on studies that had sampling bias in their original design. This could lead toward management activities that will actually save and accumulate fine fuels for reasons that have not been shown to be beneficial for sage-grouse. We saw the result of a fine fuel buildup in 2012 with massive range fires. This is not good in face of the fact that fire is the number one threat to sage-grouse. Weeds. I have found weed infestations out in the range the size of my hat. Agency personnel are dedicated and competent in spotting weeds, but they don't cover the ground like a livestock operator. Early detection is the true key to managing weeds, that and having programs in place and funded so we can act when needed. A mitigation framework will be part of going forward. Oregon and the SageCon effort worked hard to create a mechanism to allow limited, targeted strategic development. There are details to be worked out. When these are worked out, it will be largely ranchers providing the habitat and those that propose projects to provide the funding. Done well, another win-win. Sage-grouse conservation funded and jobs provided in a part of the state that needs jobs. Again, heavy on the done well. The beauty of this is it powers itself. Ranchers in the act of day-to-day ranching will do these things. What we will need from the state is continued support for coordination among the multiple agencies and landowners, programs in place and funded, mitigation at ODF&W, weed control, Oregon Department of Agriculture, Rangeland Fire Protection Associations, Oregon Department of Forestry, perhaps from time to time a mechanism for conflict resolution, and most importantly, we need, through actions, that Oregon is continued to follow through on the sage-grouse planning effort that helped lead to the decision not to list. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, John. Many excellent points there. Any questions, colleagues?
Chair Dimbro, if yes, I can ma'am. Add just one
sure.
Footnote to all of this. John O'Keefe and his colleagues I'm a newbie to the RFPAs. Certainly not, my family certainly not new to Oregon. But look at John O'Keefe not just as a great public servant through all of his volunteer activities and a terrific livestock producer. He's also a first responder. When that lightning strikes right next to his property in Lake County and it happens to be on BLM, we don't wait for somebody to call BLM. John doesn't call the BLM poobahs down there. He puts on his yellow shirt and heads out there and puts out the fire. Yeah, the small investment that we're asking has huge dividends, not just for forest health and rangeland health, but the birds. It is enormous. if we, you can keep me out of the building a lot this session by telling your colleagues in Ways and Means that I don't need to come over and work on them, that you'll take care of it for us.
Okay, well, if that's what it takes. Well,
there you go.
Sure. No, thank you very much for coming. And, John, I assume everything she said about you is correct.
Oh, absolutely.
That's right. Okay, thank you very much.
Do you have time for the video? Or?
It's
2 minutes.
Yeah, if it's posted, we could watch it on our own. I think that's probably better. So I'm going to end the informational hearing. Colleagues, we do have one of our climate sessions tomorrow night. Hope you can make it. It's going to be Carbon Markets 101.
It's going to be too hot.
And we're not meeting on Thursday, just for the record.
Okay.
So, colleagues, with that, we are adjourned.
Some of us will be up.
Adjourned.
Some of us will be up.
Colleagues, with that, we are.